welcome to episode 199 of the Cricket Her Weekly. Now, I've just got one request for you before we start. While you're watching this podcast, please, no loud noises, because last night we went out for a few drinks with none other than Don Miles, who a lot of people will recognise as a great friend of women's cricket over the years. One of only two men ever to have been a member of the Women's Cricket Association.
I know.
Women's Cricket Association did admit men right at the end of Clement's lifetime, just before it got taken over. Don Miles, one of two people that did that. And also the provider, as so often, of our photograph in the background there, because he was kind enough to give us access to his old archive and say that we could use them for stuff like this. So 80 years young, Don Miles, and still up for post-drinks in Wetherspoons. So if I'm still doing that when I'm 80, then I think I'll be doing okay. Now, okay, Raph, what's been happening in women's cricket this week?
Yeah, so I'll try and keep it quiet for you, Sid, in sympathy with your head. So let's start off by talking about the end of the India v Australia series. In last week's episode, we only watched the first of the three T20s. Australia actually went on and won the second and third T20s, and therefore won the series. The second one was quite close. They only had six balls to spare, and I think there were six wickets down at the end, Australia chasing. The third one was a little bit more of a comprehensive win, but they still only had eight balls remaining, so they weren't total walkovers. And I think some of what we said last week about T20 being a stronger format for India still holds true. I also think that there's quite a few positives that India can kind of take away in terms of having played a few of the younger players in this series against Australia, and all of them seem to have performed reasonably well. Although, let's talk about Harmanpreet Kaur's comments after that second T20, which seemed to have gone down in India like a bucket of cold sick. So this was her quote. In the 19th over, if Shreyanka was on target, it would have made a huge difference for us. A lot of people have picked up on Harmanpreet actually specifically calling Shreyanka out on having bowled that 19th over. I believe she was bowling at Phoebe Litchfield in that second T20, and Litchfield just, hit the winning runs ultimately, right? And did it with an over to spare. And Harmanpreet specifically kind of called out Shreyanka and said, kind of, it's your fault. So that was an interesting remark, Sid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day it was, but there's been, you know, a lot of discussion about whether it was the right thing to say. There was a good discussion about this on the Naughty Child podcast this week as well, where they kind of took it to pieces and they raised this comparison with Lauren Bell. So Lauren Bell, in one of those women's Ashes matches,
was the one that's Taunton in the ODI.
She conceded a pile of runs in the last over, and, you know, At the end of the day, those ones were the ones that made the difference. Heather Knight was asked in the press conference, you know, do you want to blame Lauren Bell for all this? And, you know, to her credit, she didn't do so, did she?
She didn't. It's a good comparison, I think, because obviously as captain, there's an element of kind of defending your young players and feeling defensive of them. And, you know, I think that especially when somebody is quite young, then you do feel that sort of, or you would hope that the captain would feel that kind of protective sense over them. I think there is an element of maybe the Harmanpreet Kaur's criticism has been a little bit harsh and a little bit overdone. My initial reaction was similar to Polly's on The Naughty Child, which was thinking about that comparison with Heather Knight at kind of protecting Lauren Bell at Taunton from, or trying to protect her from that criticism. But I do think there's a sense in which, as the captain, after a match, if things go wrong, you're always going to get asked by the media, why did they go wrong? That's always question number one in these in these press conferences. And ultimately, all Harmanpreet did was actually give an honest answer, because to some extent, that is where it went wrong. Because if India had managed to take it into a 20th over, then who knows what could have happened. And so Harmanpreet wasn't wrong in what she said. She wasn't incorrect in what she said.
I think that's possibly a little bit harsh on Shreyanka, if I can just come in here, because, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a batter's game, right? I mean, there was one terrible ball in the over, but the rest of the over wasn't that bad, you know. And at the end of the day, you're bowling at, you know, two batters who are very much in form. Elise Perry was at the other end, and, you know, one of the great batters of all time, you know, who's on a resurgence in form, you know, in her 30s. And at the other end of it, you know, the spectrum, you've got Phoebe Litchfield, who's like already laying claim to be the greatest batter of her generation, you know, right at the beginning of her career. And so, you know, and it just happens. If you're a bowler, you know, stuff happens.
Of course it happens. But Holmbury didn't say Shreyanka was terrible and she should never play for India again. All she said was that she wasn't quite on target with every ball and that that mattered in T20 and it mattered in that specific instance. Okay. So I suppose what I'm saying is it feels a little bit like, because I get really frustrated as a journalist when you ask Heather Knight or, you know, many other people a question and they don't give you an honest answer. And we have been critical of Heather Knight previously for actually, for example, that terrible press conference that she did after the test, where she just kind of went, oh, well, you know, it's our brand of cricket and we're having a great time and what does the result matter? And you actually, I think you want a little bit of more honest introspection from the captain when they lose, for them to actually point to moments in the game that went wrong and say, this is what went wrong and this is perhaps why and this is what we're going to do to fix it. Of course, they don't have a huge amount of time to kind of think about that and maybe absorb it. But just a little bit of honesty. And so to some extent, captains are kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. Because if they're too honest, then the media go, oh, hang on, you're picking on so-and-so. And if they're not honest, then people like me get a bit cross and go, you're trying to cover up what's really going on. So I think that some of the criticism of Holmbury has been a little bit unwarranted. Right. The other thing that I would say is that Holmbury is always doing media in not her first language. I believe her first language is Punjabi. So she's always having to do press conferences, usually in English, sometimes in Hindi. We didn't actually see her give that quote, so I'm not sure if it was in English or in Hindi. I think English. But so, you know, maybe it's coming across in a way that is a little bit kind of interpreted as a little bit harsh, just because she's having to do something that you or I would find incredibly difficult. I'm just trying to think about me trying to do a press conference in French, for example. I'd be a complete disaster.
Yeah, no, I think that is a fair point. There's one other cultural point as well, which I think is worth throwing in there, which is that you know, having myself worked in India, you know, it is kind of a harsher culture. Mm. So if you're in an office in India, it will not be surprising to hear that the boss, you know, call out somebody for doing what they consider to be poor work or substandard work in public, in front of everybody, in a way that just will be utterly unacceptable in an English or an American office. So it is a culture where people are perhaps a little more used to, you know, that idea of calling people out.
That's
and
really
kind of being talking about that in public.
Yeah.
So Shreyanka might well have not taken it in quite the same way as we kind of, in the West, will picture somebody, you know, in an England team might have taken that because it won't be quite as shocking to be called out in public in that way.
That
so I think there's an important cultural element there as well, which we need to understand.
I guess the other thing is that people aren't prepared to give Holmbury the benefit of the doubt at the moment because some of her previous behaviours over the past 12 months been quite difficult.
She hasn't helped herself,
yeah,
has she?
So particularly that the thing in Bangladesh with having a go at the umpires and sort of ruining that post-series presentation after Bangladesh had won.
I mean, do we think that Harmanpreet should be, you know, not be India captain? I mean, it's difficult. And they kind of painted themselves into a corner because, you know, the only way you can see her not being captain now is she's going to leave if she's not captain, right? She's just going to go, no, I'm not doing this
she
anymore.
She does strike us as the type of personality, doesn't she, where she wouldn't do well at kind of being in a dressing room that she'd previously been in charge of and being told what to do by somebody else. So I think, you know, questions are being asked about this, partly because she's had a really difficult run of form with the bat as well. So she's not contributing with the bat.
Yeah,
she's
doing things white ball as scores captain. In December were all terrible,
yeah.
Basically.
She's doing things as captain where you kind of really, people are very much not just raising one eyebrow, they're raising both eyebrows, Sid. And so that's why this has kind of emerged as a bit of a talking point. But yeah, I mean, who else have you got in the team who's senior enough to take on that role?
Yeah, I mean, people are instantly going, oh, well, you know, you can make Smriti captain, but I just, you know, Smriti was made captain in the WPL. It was a disaster. She's obviously kind of an introspective, introverted person.
Yeah.
Her form has still been okay over the last year. In fact, since the WPL, though, her strike rate in international cricket has subsided quite a bit. It's not gone to disaster territory, but we've gone from a strike rate where she maintained a strike rate in the 130s for like the last three or four seasons. suddenly in the last year or so it's gone down to the 100 and teens. So there's been a substantial fall off.
That's really interesting.
So she's already kind of, and I'm not saying that she's kind of struggling for form or anything like that, but she's not quite the player she has been. And it's almost like that even the responsibility that she's got now is a bit much for her. And, you know, I mean, I guess that they're going to carry on with her as captain in the WPL because, you know, that no one wants to lose face over that. But I wonder if that's really affecting her form. And I wonder if she's really the right person to take India for. Sometimes your best player isn't your best captain. Yeah. I mean, England's best player isn't the captain, right?
Absolutely.
England's best player, two players at the moment, are Sophie Eccleston and Nat Siver. And neither of them, you know, are the ones that are the right person to be captain.
No.
I think everybody accepts that, you know, including
including
the
men.
So,
but the other possibility, and I know that you'd previously talked about her as maybe being the next captain, would be somebody like Jemmy Rodrigues.
Yeah, I think that for me, she's the person I'd make India captain.
Okay.
And in fact, I would have made her captain a year ago, to be honest. Because
but
a year ago, she wasn't.
She didn't have a settled
place
in
the team. But there's sometimes there is an argument for giving someone that, you know, the captaincy, even if they don't have a settled and going, your role is to be captain. That's your key role in the team.
Well, okay, but then...
I mean, arguably, that's what Heather Knight's doing at the moment, right? I mean, you know, there would certainly be questions over Heather Knight's place in the team if she wasn't captain.
Yeah, maybe so. There should be even when she is captain. I'm just saying that I think that I personally feel that your captain needs to win a place in the team on merit rather than being there just to be
Jeremy
captain.
Jeremy Rodrigues does.
She
do
does
that
now, yes.
So
a year ago, no. But would, as we've kind of alluded to, would Harmanpreet Kaur be prepared to accept a much younger, a Rodrigues-style captain? I'm not sure about that. So you're effectively then booting out Harmanpreet Kaur, aren't you? And that's
She's had a string of four scores, but she still remains, you know, a player of enormous capacity to make match-winning contributions.
Yeah, I don't really think that the BCCI or the India coach is seriously thinking about getting rid of her. I just think we're talking about this because people are talking about it kind of on Twitter, etc.
Absolutely.
Let's also talk about the Australia captain, Sid, because we did have a question come in about Alyssa Healy from John, basically saying, can you assess her captaincy so far? So he says, I believe Australia in general are a very strong team, hence they end up winning most of the matches because they have very quality all-rounders. However, when they're about to lose, they behave just like any other team, whereas Meg Lanning used to fight till the very end, for example, in the final of the Commonwealth Games, which Australia really had no right to win, but managed to kind of come back from a losing position. It's an interesting kind of comment and question from John, really. And I suppose Alyssa Healy, you could say, well, she's only been in post for one series, but there is also an argument that she's actually been doing it for 6 months, hasn't she? And, you know, what she did in the Ashes, therefore, we can kind of also assess her on that, I think.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the captain has multiple roles, particularly in Australia. And, you know, there's certainly a big element. It's an ambassadorial role.
Yeah.
Your role is to kind of be the role model for, you know, for Australia, the kind of spokesperson for Australia and all that stuff. And Alyssa Healy, you know, continues to do a fantastic job at that. I mean, you know, she's a popular individual. She plays hard, but she plays very fair. You know, there was that interesting incident where, you know, there was a debatable catch from Jemmy, and Alyssa Healy's instinct was to go, well, if Jemmy's celebrating,
I'm walking.
She was then called back. And that's very Alyssa Healy.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and she's not going to let Australia down like that. And she's not going to let Australia down on the cricket pitch. You know, she's played reasonably well. You know, her form hasn't particularly dropped off.
She might even have been player of the series.
Yeah, in the T20s. Yep, she was. So, you know, that's all positive. But at the end of the day, she's in that role because she's a good ambassador and she's a senior player.
Mm.
She's not a great captain. She's not going to give you what Meg Lanning did. She's not going to give you what Meg Lanning did, which was, you know, the ability to be inspirational, the ability to, you know, to find that, you know, that winningness, the kind of steel that Meg Lanning, you know, had as a captain. And, you know, but who does, I think? I think that, you know,
that's a rare thing.
That
was always going to be the problem.
Yeah.
Whoever was named as captain has got a huge act to follow, haven't they, in Lanning. I will say also that I think Healy is coming to the role at quite a difficult time, because I think that under Lanning, Australia were absolutely miles ahead of everybody else. They were very dominant. Because of that early investment that Cricket Australia made in professionalism and professionalisation of the whole setup. Other countries now are at a point where they are starting to catch up a little bit. England, you know, we're seeing in India, we're seeing in South Africa, there being this increased investment in the domestic structure. And so Australia are going to find it increasingly difficult to dominate in the way that they have over the past, 10 years or so. They're going into the next World Cup, for example, they might be just about favourites, but not in the way that they have been.
It's almost been 15 years since, because even 2017, they came in, they were overwhelming favourites to win the World Cup in 2017.
They absolutely were.
So it's probably going back to sort of 2009, the last time they weren't overwhelming favourites to win a World Trophy.
So it's been a kind of long period of dominance under Meg Lanning. And I think that, as I sort of said last week, Australia sometimes under Healy do look a little bit at sea when things aren't going their way, when they feel that they're losing and a match is sort of slipping from their grasp.
Yeah, it's always written in the face of Ash Gardner somehow. Ash Gardner's face is perhaps a bit too expressive for her own good. You can always see when Australia is slipping, they'll come to Ash Gardner. And she'll be have an expression like that.
Yeah, but what Healy's really got to do is actually almost kind of teach that group of players how to handle a situation where you are losing and how to turn it around. And that is a very difficult thing to do.
Not a situation that Alyssa Healy's been in very often. She's played for New South Wales her entire career. She's played for the Sydney Sixers. She's had loads of success in domestic cricket as well as in international. Mm. Not used to losing.
So I think it's a tricky, she's got a tricky inheritance there, because on the one hand, she's got this weight of expectation of, well, under Lanning, everything was great and we won everything. Coupled with a kind of interesting moment in terms of the overall global landscape of women's cricket and where Australia now are compared with the rest of the world, which is much less far ahead than they have been previously. So I think it's a lot for Alyssa Healy to deal with. I think she's going to do a good job with it because she's got a solid head on her shoulders, I think that she will appreciate the challenges. So I'm confident that she is going to be a good captain of Australia, but I'm not confident that she's going to end up with the legacy that Meg Lanning's got, which is just one of winning everything that she touches, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Shall we talk about stuff a little bit closer to home, Sid? Because there have been some interesting announcements this week in relation to men's county cricket. So Yorkshire County Cricket Club looks like are going to have Colin Graves coming in and taking over once again, putting in a whole load of money and basically bailing them out of the financial difficulties.
Well, and also buying the club.
What's currently
a member-owned club, he's saying, I'll bail you out, but if I do that, I will own the club then. It will be my personal property. You're selling it to me.
Okay, and there's been some more announcements from Middlesex, who we already knew were in financial difficulty, but they have actually this week said, we're not going to have any overseas player because we can't afford it. Basically. So a couple of kind of very big dominant clubs within the English men's county system who are financially struggling. What's this got to do with women's cricket, Sid?
Well, the really interesting thing is what's going to happen with, you know, the tenders that are going to be going out shortly for the, you know, the new restructuring of the women's domestic game.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, handing control directly back to the counties again. So getting rid of the regional system, as you'll remember, and handing direct control of the eight women's regions back to a particular county in their region. And, you know, the default kind of options in the North East and in North London are Middlesex and Yorkshire.
Yep.
But it means that we'll be handing two of our women's franchises to organisations that are clearly in deep, deep financial trouble. And, you know, that's worrying.
It is.
You know, I mean, the Yorkshire are still going to be, even if they sell out to Colin Graves is saying, well, I actually don't have the money to do everything. I'm going to own it, but I'm going to need, you know, outside investors to come in and take some responsibility for putting cash in to keep the club going as a going concern going forwards. So, you know, they're in trouble. Middlesex are in trouble as well. And it's got to be worrying that we're handing control of our clubs to men's clubs that are potentially in financial trouble. Absolutely. We've seen in English football what can happen with this. English football, the women's game, has benefited massively from, you know, the investment from men's clubs associated with their teams. And we all know that clubs like Arsenal have put a lot of money into their women's teams and had a lot of success as a result of that. But it can work the other way. So our local club here, Reading, is in a lot of trouble. Their men's team are basically bankrupt. And the rumours are that they're going to fold any minute. And when they got into financial trouble, the first thing that went was the women's team.
Yeah.
So we've tied our women's teams to the fate of the men's teams. If the men's team get into financial trouble, the women's team are just,
it's the first thing to go.
First thing to throw out the door. Yeah. And I'm just worried that, that that's going to happen here. And obviously, the other thing that we need to be concerned about is that to ensure that Yorkshire and Middlesex, and anybody else to be fair, but these ones in particular that are in financial trouble, don't use the kind of the investment for the women's team to go, aha, we can be clever here, guys. We can bid for this women's team. The ECB will give us money
giving
for
us
that.
Money to host
and then
them.
We can use that money to buy a men's overseas for the T20 Blast. And that would be great, guys.
Yeah.
The ECB needs to be really careful to ensure they're properly ring-fenced. And Middlesex have got form on this because they got into trouble last year for using not money for the women's game, but ring-fenced money for community projects. And kind of funneling that back
to pay the salary bill for their men's first 11
back into their men's team.
Absolutely.
So the ECB need to ensure there's accountability and that the money that they give to run a women's team doesn't wind up going to bail out the men's team that are in financial trouble.
And unfortunately, there is also form in this for the counties with regard to women's teams, because we know, I'm not going to say which counties, but we know that this was going on previously. The ECB used to give money to the counties in the same way they do in the men's game. For if a county had developed a women's player that was playing for the England women's team, the county would get some money from the ECB. Okay, we know that that money did not necessarily reach the county women's team, which was where it was meant to go.
Yeah, in some cases it did, but we know there were cases where it didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what's to stop this? What's to stop that happening again? What safeguards are the ECB putting in place to make sure that this does not happen again? Because I for one, am not confident that we can just trust that Colin Graves is a really nice bloke. We haven't even mentioned racism, Sid, because we are focusing on the women's side of things, but that's also extremely problematic. I'm not worried. I'm worried that, we're going to be handing over these women's teams to people who don't have good intentions with regard to them. It is a real concern.
Okay. And finally this week, we had some sad news come through at the end of December. We learned of the death of Norma Izard. She was the England manager for 10 years in the 1980s and 1990s and helped England to win a World Cup. She was about 90 when she passed away at the very end of last year. Raf, you spent quite a bit of time with her towards the end of her life. You did a long interview with her. What can you tell us about her?
Oh, wow. Well, she just had the most amazing life, Sid. Do go and read my Crick Info piece with her, because she just, it was an incredible life. She had memories that she shared with me of growing up during the Second World War, of her house being bombed during the war, memories of playing cricket at school, and really kind of inheriting a love of cricket from her dad. As you say, the kind of crowning achievement of her career really was the becoming the England manager, having played cricket at a very high level, and then gone away and spent some time raising her two sons, and really being kind of very dedicated to them. She then kind of came back into the England women's setup a bit later in life, and basically said, I want to be the manager. She knew they were looking for a manager. They wanted there to be this very stringent application process. She ended up just writing to them and saying, you know me, you know what I can do. And they were just like, yeah, we do. You're going to have the job. And it was absolutely the right decision, because there was this kind of crowning glory moment of the 1993 World Cup final win at Lord's, which she, along with the coach Ruth Prideaux, was very much responsible for. And they really developed that team together over a number of years. And ultimately, it was a kind of first step on the path towards professionalisation of England women's cricket. And Norma was very, very modest about this kind of when I interviewed her. She basically said, oh, it was all Ruth and the team and the players, because that's the kind of person that she was. But she worked really hard behind the scenes to bring that to fruition. And she had all of these cards that she showed me that players had written her to thank her for everything that she'd done for them. There was obviously like a really kind of fun, mischievous relationship that some of the players had with her, because there are some great stories about them, you know, just winding her up about various things. But she was in charge, and she was kind of very, I think no nonsense is a good word, because she, for example, there was one tour to Australia, I think it would have been the 1984-5 Women's Ashes tour, when England went to Australia, and one of the players went out late one night and came back a bit drunk, basically, and she was so cross with it that she basically banned alcohol then for the whole tour, and she said, nobody's going to have anything to drink because I'm in charge and I'm not going to accept that. So that was the kind of person that she was. The other big thing that she contributed in terms of the history of women's cricket, which was very significant, was actually she was the person who said we should have a Women's Ashes trophy and we should formally make it the Women's Ashes. So this was in 1998 when she was the last president of the Women's Cricket Association, just before it merged with the ECB. She commissioned a friend of the family to make the Women's Ashes trophy. She said, can you carve a sort of wooden ball? And that is still the basis of the Women's Ashes trophy that we have today. It's been jazzed up a little bit subsequently, but it retains that lovely original carved wooden ball. And it was Norma Izard who had the idea that the women should have their own ashes and who actually commissioned this trophy. So what a fantastic legacy that she leaves within women's cricket.
Very much so. Okay. Well, that's all for today.
That is all for today. So thanks for listening, thanks for watching, and we will see you in a week's time. Bye-bye.
Bye.